Escape Pod 95. March 1st, 2007. Today's story, Blink, Don't Blink, by Ramona Louise Wheeler.
Hello, and welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely. We usually don't do promos at the beginning of the show, but this is cool enough that I want to make an exception.
Next time on Stranger Things.
What did you do?
How is this possible?
It's what happens to prayers!
How did you do this?
I want to try again. Can I please? I know I can make it work this time. I know it.
Stranger Things is a video podcast launching, if all goes well, later on today at StrangerThings.tv. It's produced by my friend Earl Newton, and their mission is to put out a half-hour episode every month with a feel much like the old Twilight Zone or Outer Limits. It's a science fiction anthology show, and from the early footage I've seen and the scripts I've reviewed, it's very good. The production values really are comparable with broadcast television, with serious lighting and sound. Earl's not just making this himself. He has a dedicated team of people to direct and edit, and of course, good actors. And the coolest part of this, he's shooting it and releasing it in high definition. The first episode he's releasing tomorrow is called Sacred Cows, and it's based on a creepy, unusually philosophical story by Scott Sigler. I hope this isn't speaking out of turn, but I understand he's also adapting Merle Lafferty's story, I Look Forward to Remembering You, which was heard here on Escape Pod. This is the most ambitious video podcast project I've yet heard of. I'm telling you about it because I really want Earl to succeed. He's not part of any network, and he's not doing this with any sort of initial funding or grant. It's all volunteer labor, and much like Escape Pod, he's going to be relying on his audience to help support it. So if this sounds like something you want to see, check it out at StrangerThings.tv. And if you like it, tell your friends and blog about it to help make sure there's a second episode next month, and a third, and a fourth. I know I'll be looking for great things from it. Our story this week is also very ambitious, and somewhat on the dark side. We present Blink, Don't Blink by Ramona Louise Wheeler. Miss Wheeler lives in Massachusetts, and she's had numerous stories published in Analog over the past 10 years. She's also the author of a very highly regarded text on Egyptian religion, and she writes the only English-language horoscope based on the Egyptian calendar for a newspaper in Dubai. The story is read for us by Salim Fadli, a longtime supporter of Escape Pod, open-source developer, and copyright activist. He also maintains the podcasts for Resonance FM in London. So lean back and close your eyes, then open them, then close them again. It's story time.
Blink, Don't Blink by Ramona Louise Wheeler. They called him Happy Hapgood, but he wasn't. His name was really William Hapgood, and he was a murderer. He had attacked his lover in a fit of hysterical rage, then slammed her against a wall when she laughed at him for it. Death had been beyond his perception at that instant. He had only wanted to create pain, to create something as enormous as the agony that her loving had become. He accomplished that, but for Matilda, it had been mercifully brief. "Pay attention, Happy," the computer's doctor voice said. "You blinked out of sequence. Focus on the light, Happy. Blink. Don't blink. On the signal." William turned his attention to the outward blaze of blue-white light. "Blink. Don't blink." He forced his dry eyes to keep the rhythm of the computer's command. It was easier to let his attention wander. Focusing too closely on his eyes made him aware of the nanite armies marching steadily in rows across his cornea, receiving their orders from the flashing signals in the light. The flashes were too rapid for William's human perception, but his nanites, his interior wardens and prison guards, they read their instructions with bug-easy calm, spreading through him to their assignments elsewhere within the cage his flesh had become. He could not feel them, they were too small, but the knowledge of them crawled across his eyes. "That's right, Happy," the computer said. "You've got the rhythm now. The download will be finished in a flash." It was. The blue-white light surged like boiling clouds in blue skies. There was nothing of him anymore but a memory of himself floating in the dark. Blink. Don't blink. Don't blink. Pause. Okay, blink. Now close them. William returned to the dark. Payne was a different light, revealing landscapes of himself. He could feel his fingers growing, his bones condensing and merging with the steel rod structure of the machine to which the nanites were bonding him, outlined in colours of pain. This process was not quite so crude as being lashed into place with duct tape, but the stretch and the constriction and the helplessness were as primitive and infuriating. He was growing places and parts that were not human, not himself. He was part flesh and part machine. His skin expanded, stretching into a blunt caricature of his human shape, covering hands that ended now in rock-pounding jackhammers anchored deep into his bone. His legs and torso were locked into the body of the machine, huge, distorted to give mass and force to the pounding tools in his hands. The machine fed him and tended him, and the impulse from his brain to his legs to walk drove enormous tank treads. He was the machine. Killing Matilda had never been William's intention. That was why the courts could not have killed him. The hysteria and rage of the moment had been spent in a single blow. That was all that was needed to end Matilda's vicious, mean-spirited life. She was the most beautiful thing that William had ever seen and ever would. He thought so, even as he looked down at her, broken and final at his feet. For the first time he had won the argument with her, but she had won everything else. Hadn't the good captain said, after all, that there was no right way to hit a woman? William pounded the rubble of walls and rocks in front of him, knocking aside pieces in his way. He didn't know where he was going, but the nanites knew the way. They were navigating for him with simple expedients. He only had to keep walking in the direction they pointed with his headlights, and to keep pounding the rubble, anything that got in his way. The satellite navigation systems overhead sussed out his pathway with radar and other such supernatural senses. Their signal guided the headlights and the beam that was the string that William followed through the labyrinthine maze of his dark and fallen place. The machine part of him ate what elements it needed in the rubble to feed his transformed body. William just kept on walking, pounding the world out of his way as he went. Stop! Stop! Happy! Please stop! The order had to be repeated to make him listen. William, please! William stopped, digging his tank-like treadfeet into the gravel, slumping. The heavy hammer hands dropped to his side with a noise of shattering stone. Good! The computer voice was different. William vaguely acknowledged that this was a human voice in the radio embedded in what was left of his ears. He shouldn't be able to tell the difference, and he did not wonder why he could. They had blocked the sound from him so that he could only pound rocks and move walls of rubble, therefore he did not hear the people now gathered around him. He was not looking for them, and he did not see them coming. Faces appeared in the viewplate of the dome that covered his head. He still had his head. It was netted in machines and layers of plastic, but it was his head. Dirty, frightened human faces glared at him through the layers. They pounded on his dome head with all their hands, as though they could break through to him. These are the people we sent you to rescue, William was told by the voice in his ear. Now you just have to change again. They need transport out of here, and some are injured. William was struck by how tiny their little natural human hands looked pressed against his dome. Their faces were terrible to see, but those hands, those ordinary, helpless little hands, were a dreadful fixation in his sight. It was a relief when the blue-white light swelled up in his vision, and the voice began the chant. Blink. Don't blink. Don't blink. Blink. The agony of changing, of stretching and growing into something different took over, and he thought only about his own hands. He felt their feet walking along his spine. He was a huge automated ambulance now, providing life support for them with his own lungs and heart and blood. The nanites took from him everything the survivors needed, and he felt himself draining away. When they let him sleep, he had dreams of being the roast dinner set upon a table before rows of hands holding knives and forks, and he always woke with the taste of his own flesh in his mouth. William carried the rescued survivors back through the tunnel he had pounded. He travelled more slowly with their weight inside him. He had to keep pausing to feed himself from the debris. There were seven of them, seven survivors out of a thriving underground factory with thousands of workers. The supposedly indestructible, earthquake-proof structure had collapsed during a relatively minor quake. The resulting political upheaval was none of William's concern or awareness. He was crawling on his hands and knees through broken rubble, carrying seven strangers on his back while he fed them with his own blood. He had no choice in his actions. His brain chose the safest pathway ahead, following the yellow circles of the headlight, dragging himself forward with an urgency that he himself did not really feel, but was nevertheless compelled to act upon. When the last survivor was out and had been carried away by the helicopters with human faces, William was parked in the corner of a hangar, chained to the wall by the rear bumper of the ambulance machine part of him, and plugged into an intravenous feeding tube that hung down from a nest of overhead lines. He could see a single wedge of landscape through the open hangar door, where press copters, police and chase cars were unweaving themselves from a tangle of excitement in pursuit of the fleeing helicopters. William watched where the lot cleared, and the last maintenance men removed the leavings of the crowd. He did not know where this was on the planet. The horizon seemed far away. Long-legged birds he did not recognise drifted down to graze along the grass edges of the landing field, as the sun set somewhere else in the sky. When night fell, it fell all at once with a numbing totality. They had not yet returned his hearing, so he sat in a silence as black as the night that had fallen. William had admitted his guilt, so he was given choices for his sentence. Acts of passion are things of the flesh and not always of the soul. He could accept 100 years in cryo. He would wake a free man after that century, but in an entirely unknown, unknowable future, with no resource to call upon but his own person. He could choose to take 10 years in the hard labour camps of Lunar Colony, digging oxygen ore from the deep mines and sleeping in tubes. Or he could do 1 year of community service, saving lives around the planet, as a sentient tool in the hands of the Nanosity Institute. William was a passionate man and impatient, virtues which had brought him to this triple threat crossroads. He chose community service, scorning the warnings that he would be given a full year of his life, every single second of it, without escape. He faced the judge squarely and told her that helping people directly seemed to be the most appropriate way to atone for his act of passion. The judge was impressed that William knew the word appropriate. She told his lawyer to stop coaching him. "He didn't tell me that, ma'am," William said, forgetting again that he was supposed to address the judge as Your Honour. "That woman what I killed, she taught me that word, ma'am. Matilda taught me everything, every single day. I could never do anything appropriate to the moment. She told me I could never dress appropriately, like the kind of gentleman she deserved. She said I'd never done anything appropriate in my life. And it's time, ma'am, time I did something appropriate." The judge let him have community service, saying nothing about his having called her ma'am. Blink, don't blink, don't blink, blink. The human voice was familiar this time, expected. New orders did not come from the computer voices. "This one will have to happen in a hurry. While we're airlifting you to the crash site, it will be rougher than the first." It was. William listened to the hard drone of aircraft engines in the flight. He had let that sound become the direction he followed, while the pain made him into another shape so swiftly that he did not even know what he was becoming. His nanite had been commanded into emergency pitch. William was certain he could feel them racing through his cells. Bubbles of agonizing carbonization swelled his joints and made thick rubber bands of his ligaments that bound to surging muscle, to crackling bone. Pain as swift as racing shadows guided his demonic host of nanites. The last nausea-racked moments of the transformation happened to him as he fell through the air, suspended from the claws of a modified glider chute with a human face embedded in the midst of its rigging. William tried to see that face in the eye-watering brightness of the sky above him as he fell. All he could make out was the face hanging high above him, was looking down as carefully at him, blinking rapidly in the brilliant light. The newness of this swift pain was so immense that William could only hold on to the memory of his first glimpse of Matilda, dazzling under the waist-long blonde hair she wore as a golden mane, an angelic halo around her perfect face. She was dancing. She lifted those curls, flicking the sweet honey waves behind her, in time to the driving beat of the music, in a gesture so purely female and perfect that she owned his heart utterly before the mane had settled back across her back. As he fell from the sky, he could hear only her voice. The nanites were finishing up their work, reshaping him even as he touched down in the swamp. He floundered for desperate minutes, awaiting the orientation of the radio voices in his head. For a terrible, terrifying time, he felt the grasp of the swamp water dragging him below the surface as sweet as Matilda's long, long legs wrapped tightly around him as he drowned in her. His sides were stretched out into pontoons that kept him afloat. His legs were webbed, clawed and huge, pushing him along the noxious mud. He cut away the leaves and plants in his path by slashing his machete arms around him. Nothing stood in his way. William could not feel the slithering touch of things that crawled in the swamp mud, but he could hear them. He was not safe in a cocoon of silence this time. He had to listen for thin sounds of human wailing, the noise of the alive and endangered creatures in his pathway as he crawled to the airline wreckage. William had to force himself not to think about the life surging around him. It had nothing to do with him. He had just to keep walking, keep pushing through the dense, soft bog oozing life, and follow the lights that guided him. He heard the crackle of flames ahead of him before the voice in his radio link talked to him about it. The swamp ahead began to glow. The crackle rose to a roar with the cries of fleeing birds. A light filled the horizon above the dense foliage, rising into the sky. Remote control machines guided by engineers with the training of video game wizards can do a great deal. The success rate goes up markedly if there's a certain amount of genuine sentience right there on the machine on site. William did not need to wait for his handlers to assess the situation, decide how he should respond, and instruct him to protect himself. They did not have to tell him to turn around and run away from the fire. The impulse of fear was powerful enough to make his hindbrain override the nanite guidance system. He raced back through the swamp, skimming across fetid water where he could, with the roar of flames and screams of the dying chasing after him. His machete arms were a whirl of blades, scattering everything in his way. His headlights swung back and forth wildly, leaving him with no guidance except for the blind terror driving him onwards. Eventually, William got used to the pain of the nanites as they worked him over, rebuilding him, grafting onto him yet another rescue machine. The radio voice in his ear told him that he had to be conscious whilst they changed him because the nanites were guided by the nerve impulses, impulses of attention to himself. Whilst he slept, they twitched in his bloodstream and tissue along with his REM paralysis. He had to feel the pain. The chemicals of pain in his cells were fuel to the restless nanite hordes that reconstructed him. William became thickened to it, seeing it finally as simply the light by which he viewed the landscape of himself changing, growing, shaping around the machine. Lightning flashes of new pain sometimes outlined his bones, remolded or lungs overtaxed. In these moments, William could see Matilda's exquisite face, laughing at him one last time. There was no rest. He could sleep, but there was no rest, and the nanites kept the chemicals of fatigue under control. His life became an alternating blur of pain and panic, riding in demon machines over a black ocean of guilt. Somewhere, in a place he could neither name nor locate within himself, he remembered without ceasing how much he loved Matilda, had always loved her, and would always love her. A love fed by steady disbelief that he could have done what he had done. Over this black ocean, shining over the hidden place that was the brilliant pain of her beauty, the cruel light of that ugly thing she had become before he killed her. William did not measure time, only the people he rescued, pulled out of rubble from flooded subway tunnels and sinking oil well platforms. He counted corpses carried up one by one from the ocean bottom amid airplane wreckages, but not days. The year passed. They cut him away from his machine and made him man-shaped again. They put a suit on him so he could sit in a courtroom office in front of the judge. She put papers in front of him to sign, explaining what they meant, and then found that she had to remind him how to hold the pen. His fingers felt tiny and childlike, primitive. The pen seemed like such a huge stick of wood that he could barely control. He put his thumbprint beside the shaky signature. The judge asked him if he were willing to talk to the Nanosity Institute representative before the nanites were removed. William sat with shock roaring through his ears. It was over. They would take away his nanite wardens. He had known it would end, but he found he could not bear the thought of being alone, with no one there inside his flesh with him. There would only be himself. He looked down to his useless hands and nodded. "Yes, please," he said. His voice was rusty, his vocal cords newly restored. He cleared his throat. "I'll talk to him." They could see William was shaken. They left him sitting there while the Nanosity representative was called in. Perhaps everyone in this position reacted the same at this moment. He was offered a cup of coffee or a glass of water, but he shook his head, afraid that he might have forgotten how to hold a cup. The man from Nanosity was sleek and expensively dressed. He was apparently familiar with the state of shock in which William sat. He placed his chair to one side and slightly behind William, so that when he sat down, he could lean forward and speak soothingly into William's ear. It was easier to recognise this voice when William could not quite see his face. For a year, William had listened to this same voice saying, "Blink, don't blink, don't blink, blink." William sat calmly listening. "My name is Yvonne Isidoro," the man from Nanosity said. "I think you'll recognise me." William nodded. "Good. Nanosity Institute is quite impressed with your progress over the last year, William. We're wondering if you'd like to reconsider having your nanite system removed. Perhaps you'd stay on with us instead. You've had a year of education like no other. Nanosity Institute is willing to turn that training into a career. We subsidize this community service program because it's such a good way to make people learn what you've learnt. We can make it worth your while, William. William, I think you'll find that a career as a nanotechnologist on the frontiers of human industry and exploration can be very rewarding, personally as well as financially. You've gotten really good at symbiotic performance with the smaller rescue machines. But think about being at the helm of some really big machines. Something exciting. Maybe even a spaceship someday. William sat staring at his ordinary, helpless human hands. He felt the horror of what those hands had done. He also felt the greater dread of remaining small, fragile and human. He turned in the chair and looked at Yvonne Isidoro directly. "Does anyone ever refuse to join Nanosity after they've been through this?" William asked. The man from Nanosity shook his head, his eyes sliding away for an instant from William's. "Not very many," he smiled in a smooth professional smile. "Then you knew I'd agree to join." "We do believe in giving you the choice," he replied. William said he would join, and then he sat wondering what he would do with himself until they gave him another machine.
And that was our story. There's a lot of fascinating implications in this culture. I can only imagine the children's games. When I grow up, I want to be a fire engine. We've had a couple of takers on our call for more audio comments last week, including this one from Jake, who's clearly been listening to the early Escape Pod episodes. He went old school and sent us a book review, much like the ones we used to run.
"Hey, Escape Pod, my name is Jake. Even though I'm only 15, I've still been a sci-fi fan for a long time. I'd like to review The Mothman Prophecies by John Keel. Yeah, I did see the movie, but it definitely wasn't as good, nor as believable as the book, which was set in West Virginia in the 1960s or so. It's really not a story. It's more of a sequence of individual events, all of which involve the paranormal. Things like a giant mothman, floating lights, and a supposed alien, Indrid Cold. The book was especially cool for me, since I have been to the towns in the book. Did I mention it's nonfiction? Yeah, each event in the book is actually told by eyewitnesses or actual secondary sources like the person's friend or a newspaper. It's kind of creepy, too, because my grandparents' house in West Virginia is near a large patch of woods, which, as sci-fi fans should know, are always creepy at night, and that's where I read the book, so, ugh. Take up the book, it's a fun read, and also very interesting, because it also goes through the history of many paranormal phenomena. Maybe some of the witnesses are still alive, and you can talk to them if you have a chance to visit the towns in the book. Anyway, keep the great stories coming, Steve. Thanks. Bye."
Thanks, Jake. If anyone else wants to send us capsule book reviews, you can do it at 206-666-EPOD, or send us an audio file at feedback@escapepod.org. Remember that to fit in this outro, your message needs to be a couple of minutes or less, or else I pull out my sound editing scalpel and begin surgery. So, the feedback to Kay Kenyon's alien abduction relationship story, The Acid Test, was rather lukewarm. Several people liked it, for presenting what they thought was a realistic dynamic between husband and wife. Several others disliked it for the same reason. Gary said, "This story was just too much Lifetime TV tries to do sci-fi." And Lee wondered, quote, "if it would have worked better as a flash piece, distilled down to a more potent delivery." There wasn't a strong vibe of anyone hating the piece, but clearly the central theme of relationship testing was one that either worked for people in their fiction or it didn't. The following week's story, Mike Resnick's The Boy Who Yelled Dragon, was mostly popular with our commenters. A few people, like JC and Contra, observed that the twist was pretty obvious, nor the ending was too abrupt, but seemed willing to give it a pass as an obvious children's story. Others enjoyed it straight out, and still others didn't like it as a kid's story. I think Chronocars did the best balancing act. He said, "I liked the story very much. It was short, funny, and fun. But I believe it wasn't really Escape Pod material." I think I can see where you're coming from, Kay, but if you're liking the stories anyway, I think it's likely we'll continue to experiment from time to time. And one final administrative note, our 300-word flash fiction contest is nearly at an end. We had a truly staggering number of entries, more entries than allowed words, in fact, and the seventh and last semi-final round is ending this weekend. On Saturday, I'll be posting the poll for the final round, and you'll have 7 days to read and choose your favorite stories. If you haven't participated yet, this is a good time, because we're really down to the best of the best, and there are some great pieces here. This is all at our forums at forum.escapeartists.info, and you do need to register to be able to read the stories. And I think we're about to run out of theme music, so Escape Pod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is distributed on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Check out our horror podcast, Pseudopod, and buy our CDs at poddisc.com. Theme music is by permission of Daikaiju at daikaiju.org. That was our show for this week. Until next week, keep blinking and have fun.